Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode of Rock On Tours was recorded before the passing of Taylor Hawkins.
Hello, Gary.
Hey, Guy.
So, interesting one this week. Rick Astley, a man of supreme reinvention.
Yeah, like he's reinvented himself quite a few times. I mean, going from being the sort of PWL puppy and making, you know, being part of that sausage factory of music, which actually is still probably making PWL a fortune as we speak.
Well, apparently there was a rumor at the time that that if you did sessions, like backing singers, and there were hardly any musicians, but if you did sessions for PWL, they didn't actually pay you because they didn't have to, because anything they did was guaranteed so much radio play that you'd get massive PPL payments and stuff.
Wow.
So that,
I'm taking it you didn't play on any of those records. It was all synth bass.
No. It's all synth bass, yeah.
And then, of course, reinventing himself with that album Free later on, where he just sort of ended up writing the whole album and working with Elton John, and then with 50.
Yeah, 50, which is, yeah, very impressive. But then, you know, the greatest meme of all time.
For the Rick Rolling.
Yeah.
Can we say Rick Rolling? Are you allowed to say that? It's not like rude or anything, is it?
No. He's certainly made his peace with it.
Well, I didn't know what Rick Rolling was until doing this research, but apparently I'm one of only, you know, I mean, billions of people have been Rick Rolled and I haven't.
Yeah, no. Well, I always remember the great one. We'll talk about it. It was when the Foo Fighters Rick Rolled the Westboro Baptist Church, and they turned up on a van all dancing to Never Gonna Give You Up outside the, you know, those horrific, nasty, homophobic.
Yeah. And of course he's been on stage with Foo Fighters. They embraced him. They took him on stage. They did this amazing Teen Spirit version of Never Gonna Give You Up. And so, you know, as the generations have moved on.
Never mind Gonna Give You Up.
And then recently he's now singing Smith songs with the Blossoms. So there's lots of rock in what appears on the surface to maybe not so rock.
Exactly. And that didn't sound like a desperate attempt to placate our audience at all, Gary.
But I might as well say prog now, because it's not going to get mentioned anywhere else in this episode.
That doesn't actually bother me. Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hey, Rick.
How are you?
Rick.
So good to see you.
And you, my dears.
My God.
We've all got guitars behind us, I think, have we?
Yeah, well,
we
do.
You look like you're in a proper booth there.
No, I've got massive hair envy, Guy. I don't know about you, but that quiff.
Hey, that's why I was a bit late, by the way. I was getting the quiff ready. My glasses are still steaming up in the process.
I wish I could be late for something because I had to be getting my quiff ready.
I love it. I love it.
He keeps his in a box.
Yeah.
Where are you, Rick?
I'm at home, actually. This is my converted garage at the back of the house. And to be honest, I wouldn't say I've strategically put those guitars there, but every other corner of this room is a mess. And so I thought I'd better just put the
We all do strategic guitar
placing. Okay, great.
And if you had a studio,
like politicians
at home,
put all their most Nazi books on their
away.
Shelf.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've had this. We moved here about 8 years ago. We live near Hampton Court, and I've always had little setups at home. I had a professional studio once, like a full on, you know, with a 2-inch machine and all the rest of it back in the day and everything in Parsons Green. And I think because it had just been a boyhood dream, do you know what I mean, of messing around with gear over the years. And then when I could afford it, I just said sod it and went for it and had a studio built. And it was just in that time when things were becoming digital and also just doing everything with the computer. And then all of a sudden a desk and a tape machine, not for everybody, but for a lot of people, became completely redundant, you know. So
let me just explain to our listeners, a two-inch machine means that the tape is 2 inches wide. Yeah. It doesn't mean that there's a little machine.
It's a fucking enormous.
Fantastic.
It is 2 inches.
What a splendid German engineering.
Very compact, yeah. Yeah, and obviously we're of an age, all of us, that we grew up with going to studios where it was so expensive to do anything, simply because the tape cost a fortune, the studios themselves cost a fortune, everything. But I just still wanted to do it. It was like, instead of, I guess a lot of people drive a Ferrari into a pool, and I thought, well, I'll throw the money down the drain by having a little studio. You know what I mean? Same sort of relief, well, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one thing that really surprised me listening to your back catalogue was the quality of production on 50.
Oh, well, thank you.
Which I think came out 2016, right?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And I'm looking for the producers, and it's just you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I did it all here.
You played everything.
I did, yeah, I did. It was kind of like, it was a birthday present to myself, that record. I kind of, I mean, don't get me wrong, I wasn't expecting to even necessarily make what we call a record anymore. I was making a collection of songs, and I was going to see what happened. And I bought a new computer. I bought a couple of bits and bobs. And I got into this room. This was the first room in the whole of the house, actually, that we finished properly. And I just said, well, I'm just going to have a go at something, because I was about to be 50 years old. And when thinking of a title for the collection of songs, because Adele was obviously the biggest artist in the world and possibly still is, and I just sort of thought, well, I'll pinch that one before she gets there. But not thinking that anyone would ever really hear it. I thought my mum would and a few friends, and that'd be it. So,
oh, that's very modest of you, Rick.
Well, no, I don't think it is, if I'm honest. I think making records today is not what it was. And I think even if you've got a, you know, I thankfully went back to the label that I used to be with, BMG, and they were up for it. And they really did an amazing job and really went for it. But, you guys know the score. You can have a half decent or even a great record, and it still gets lost in the wind. Do you know what I mean? And so,
because there's sort of two Rick Astley's in people's minds, or maybe there's only one. And unfortunately,
there's about 12.
Missed.
There's about 12 in my mind, Gary. Just so you know.
Let me just follow this through, guy. They sort of missed this second one. I know, actually, 50 went to number one. What am I talking about? In 2016, it's a number one album. But this is a guy, if you just heard 50, you couldn't imagine this is a bloke who was singing other people's songs ever. Because the production, as we said, is incredible.
Thank you.
The songwriting is really beautiful. The vocal stuff. I mean, it's as good as anything that was happening contemporarily at that time.
Thank you.
You know, does that frustrate you a little bit?
No. If I, again, just before I did that, and the years building up to it, let's say, I'd started to gig again. I quit for like 15 years or more. And I know we're sort of shooting everywhere right now, but I quit, don't know when it was, in the early, mid-90s. I'd had enough of it all. I'm sure everyone had had enough of me, I can tell you that. And we had our daughter by then. I developed a fear of flying, and I think that was just a symptom of not wanting to go places and promote records. And so I did nothing for years in terms of music. I had a little studio and I this, that and the other, but I didn't really release records properly. Not properly anyway, you know. And so when I'd gone through a period of also doing a lot of retro gigs with a lot of other artists, somebody you know very, very well, Gary, we won't get into that right now, but anyway, lots of different artists. And to be honest, I actually genuinely loved it, because I started it because I got an offer to go to Japan to sing my old songs. And my wife and our daughter really, really wanted to go to Japan. They'd both never been. I'd been at various times. So we turned it into a family trip. And so I've done a lot of, from that moment, which is, I think it was 2006, 2008, something like that, a little light went on and I started joining in with other people at retro gigs and doing my old songs and everything. And I loved it. It was super easy. It was super simple. I wasn't necessarily the headline, you know what I mean? Sometimes I was, sometimes I wasn't. And it was just great to go up there and do your 45 minutes or your hour slot if you were lucky. And after doing that for a number of years, I kept thinking, I'm convinced there's still some more music left in me. And when I was, when 50 was approaching, which let's face it, is a big one, I just thought, sod it, I'm just going to have a go at making a record and we'll see. We'll see whether we release it properly, whatever. So just the fact of being what I would call in like a musical wilderness for a very long time and then doing essentially, and I know it's a dirty word to some people, but doing like retro gigs, I still felt I had something to, not even prove, but something to offer. And I thought, how amazing would it be to sing some new songs in front of lots of people? That feeling I craved again. And so that's why I did it really, yeah. But I don't have any negativity about any of my life in music, you know, at all, not at all.
But also because you were writing all the way back to the PWL.
Yeah,
days.
I mean,
you were getting songs on albums.
I was extremely lucky because when I signed, obviously, to Stock Aitken Waterman's production company, they had no intention of anybody. I mean, some of the artists did actually, to be fair. Bananas always did. Dead or Alive did. But a lot of the artists they worked with, especially later on as well, the idea was, you're a bit like Motown, you turn up, sing that song, off you go, you know, and that was the deal. But
like Kylie.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, you know, and anybody really, to be honest. I think pretty much everybody who went through that building, I think towards Dead or Alive was very different because people knew them anyway. But I just think the combination of Stock Aitken Waterman and Dead or Alive gave As You Spin Me Round, yeah, which I think is one of the best classic pop songs of,
incredible,
you know, it's just amazing. Right. And loads of others that they did.
Because funnily enough, I first heard about them when they produced Brilliant, which was the band that I was in,
right? Okay,
which was co-founded by my mate Youth from
right,
Killing
sure.
Joke,
yeah, yeah.
And they were very much a kind of cool underground dance label at that point.
Yeah, I mean, the weird thing was, I think they hit a vein of gold or diamond, platinum, whichever way you call it, and they just mined it forever, kind of thing. They just went for it. And but some of the, I mean, just think about that, just what you've just mentioned there, and also Dead or Alive, the Bananas, Princess, which
the
is
bananas.
One of the first ones. Sorry, I call them Bananarama, sorry, I call them the Bananas, so I love the girls.
But I think one of the first tracks they had out, I can't name it, was championed by John Peel.
Wow.
An early electro dance track.
Wow.
Stock Aitken.
Yeah, so they were a sort of cool undergroundy thing. And it, well, because Pete had been producing loads of stuff for Stiff, hadn't he? For Stiff Records.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't know much about them before that, really. I know they'd done a lot of High Energy Records and Hazel Dean. You know, they had some big hits with her in terms of like, in a certain space, if you want to call it that, if you know what I mean. I know obviously Hazel had proper hits as well, but I'm saying there were certain artists that went through that building that almost had an alternative career to what they ended up doing, if you know what I mean. But anyway, just going back to the you, because you mentioned about me getting a few songs on the first album. Pete Waterman wanted me to sign to a major label because he kind of felt he needed to push the boat out a bit. And he knew Pete Robinson, who was the head of A&R at RCA. And I also think he had wind that BMG were going to own RCA pretty soon. And because he's no mug, Pete Waterman. I mean, you know, people can say whatever they like about him one way or another, all the rest of him. He's a bit like Uncle Pete to me still, to be honest. But that guy's switched on big time. So Pete said, look, he took me in for a meeting with Pete Robinson at RCA. And Peter Robinson said, well, I'm going to have to hear Rick sing. I can't just sign him because you believe in him, Pete, you know. And Pete said, not a problem. Went back to the PWL studios and kind of said to Matt and Mike, Stott and Aitken, look, we're going to do a showcase with Rick. And they went, we're not, we're busy, we're making records. So I went home to a tiny little four-track studio where I'd done my demos up until that point. Again, where I played everything and put them together. Took my vocal off, came back down to London with a cassette, played that cassette in some crappy what have you, sang through an SM50M mic, which FM58 mic, which is, if anyone listening, that's the standard bog mic you have when you go out and play live in a club or a pub. Through a crap old speaker with no reverb in the reception and sang these four demos that I had. And at the end of it, so there's Pete Waterman, there's Pete Robinson, there's the head of PWL business, if you like, David Howells, my manager, da da da. So there's like four or five guys just looking at this kid in his check jacket from Next or whatever I had on. And then Pete Robinson said, who wrote these songs? And without batting an eyelid, that fast, Waterman says, he's a great songwriter as well. Because in that flash, I think he realised, Pete Robertson thought, it'd be great if Rick wrote a couple of tunes as well. It'd be great if he wasn't just like a, you know what I mean? So I got four songs on that first album. None of them were singles, and they didn't deserve to be fair, but I got four songs on it. And obviously it did really well, that record, and, you know, so... Look,
before we get into the whole of making that record, and especially, the, you know, the most famous
of course.
Track.
Yeah, yeah.
let's go back to you discovering music as a kid.
Wow, yeah. Okay. I have two older brothers and an older sister, and when I was about 10 years old, we've discussed this quite a lot, my sister Jane and I, she took me to the Free Trade Hall in Manchester, and she took me to see two bands at different times, but around the same time, and I can't remember which one is first. I don't think she can. So it was either Camel, and they were doing the Snow Goose tour. By the way.
Oh my God, I did think we'd be saying the word prog in this episode.
You say the word prog in every episode, man, by the way. I've been listening, by the way.
We can't believe that you've brought the prog.
There you go. We've got to. Let's not even go there. We'll get into that in a minute. We'll get into that in a minute.
Camel.
Let's not even start with magma and egg. We won't even go there. So,
have an egg change their name to duck? Yeah, sorry, well, that'll come later.
And I went to that gig with my sister, and I was a bit like a fashion accessory, I think. Everyone was like smelling a patchouli oil and the whole thing, and it was like pretty, I wouldn't have done that hippy-dippy, that's probably wrong, but to me as a 10-year-old, it was amazing. And my sister Jane did various things like that. She took me to, we had a cafe, I think it was called the Talk of the Town, in this little town that I'm from, Newtley Willows. It was in Earlstown, actually, which is a borough of it, blah, blah, blah. She sort of introduced me to a lot of things without me realizing it, if you know what I mean. And my sister Jane loved every kind of music. I'm talking about everything. So, for instance, in her bedroom, she'd be playing Northern Soul when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, yeah, what have you.
I can hear that influence.
She'd be playing Motown, obviously. So, for instance, let's say Marvin Gaye, she'd go from that, but then she'd play all the David Bowie on the Orange. Was that RCA? All those kind of, and so I was just smothered in music from my sister, who was 10 years older than me. She loved the Beatles as well, so I kind of grew up on that without realising. And then my brother John, who is 3 years younger than Jane, he, like, Night of the Opera was one of his favourite records, and I could never touch it, but I was allowed to listen to it outside the door of his bedroom, if you know what I mean.
And that then, white cover is a bit precious, right?
Exactly. And then my brother Mike is 3 years younger, so when he started getting into certain things, and he was a massive Smiths fan. But again, like, they were all quite eclectic in the music taste, to be honest, and I just got
Camel sits outside everything that you've just said.
Yeah, but my sister, for instance, my sister Jane, and my brother John to some degree, I mean, put it this way, to give you a clue, right, I mean, people listening to this must be thinking, what the hell, but I know you guys talk about
they always think
bit,
that yeah. every week, don't
okay,
worry.
Okay, so for instance, just as a clue, right, when Rick Wakeman announced he was playing his Six Wives of Henry VIII outside the palace down the road from where we live, I went and bought 12 tickets straight away.
12?
Because I knew I'd have to, you know, my brothers, my sister, and I'd have to get them all
minute,
of them.
Mate.
No, well, come on. No, this is...
Or were you touting?
No, this was just had to be done because I thought, he's never going to do this again. This is only like 10 years ago or what have you, right?
Oh, okay,
so,
all right.
So,
okay,
but I grew up on those records. Journey to the Centre of the Earth, Richard Burton, all of that stuff. It's just ingrained in me somewhere. All the early Genesis, I know you two are going to wet yourselves now, but all the early Genesis, I knew it note for note, heart by heart, all you know, Topographic Oceans, all of that.
God damn!
Sitting in, you know, a friend's, you know, bedroom, listening to music that we'd sort of pinched records from older, and then we'd be sat there listening to them, and just mind-boggling. And then the other gig that she took me to, and I don't know which was first, was Supertramp. For me, there was two. Yeah, but there's two things. There are two things about those gigs, actually, in terms of a young kid going to them and seeing them, was that musically they were pretty mad. And even though Supertramp were like amazing at writing like real, I want to call them pop songs, you know, just great classic pop songs. They had weird, crazy instrumental sections in those songs.
Yeah, really long.
That to me didn't sound any different to Mirage or Snow Goose. It was just, oh, here's the flute solo.
Yeah.
I get that.
I think you're right about Supertramp.
Yeah.
They did have a sort of a prog, you know, musicality that was very strong. Yeah, in fact, I saw them supporting whoever's left of Supertramp now. I saw them supporting Yes at the O2 just before lockdown.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
So they're in that, yeah. They're in that world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I was at school, Crime of the Century was one of the biggest albums of my whole stay there. Yeah. Everyone was obsessed.
Just great songs. Great songs, I think. And also quite individual. I don't think they really sounded like anything else. Partly because of the kind of weird solos and the mad arrangements and what have you. You know, it wasn't... And it was just amazing and it blew me away. But just a side note... Sorry, I'm flitting everywhere, to be honest. I've had two coffees.
No, I like, we like,
we love okay. it. We love it.
Two coffees and I'm on my third cup of tea. Oh, sorry, my third drink of the day, which is tea. So I'm in Japan.
You rock and rollers.
I'm in Japan about, what would that be, 15 years... Well, whatever, when I was 22, 23, first tour, we're doing shows in Japan and we're all sat in this airport lounge, the crew, the band, everybody. The big gang of us, and someone said, right, we're playing first gig ever. So they're all going around to all these gigs and legendary gigs and blah, blah, blah. And it got to me, and I had to stand, you had to stand up and say, and I said, well, it was Free Trade All, it was Camel, because I thought it was Camel. So Chris, who was doing our sound at the time, jumps up, and Ken, who was doing our, because we had like a 35mm projection, both jumped up and went, I did that gig. and they were like looking at me like this pop kid from, you know, he was 22 years old, whatever I was. And just thinking, what the hell was he at that gig? What? How does this doesn't compute, you know what I mean? We've just heard him singing all these songs, Never Gonna Give You Up, Together Forever, whatever. And somehow it turns out his first gig was Camel. What the hell's going on? But that's having older brothers and sisters, I think.
Well, you were a musician at that point. Did you think, I want to play guitar?
It was drums you started on, wasn't it?
Oh. I did start on drums, but no, I wasn't a musician at all. My mum, and dad divorced when I was about four. And we ended up living with my dad. It's a complicated thing, and I don't mind talking about it, but it's just one of them things, and so we did. And my mum was not a prodigy, is a bit much, really, but she was an amazing piano player, and she could sight-read classical. But she could also, if anybody just started singing a song, she would hear the key, go to the piano, and play the song. And that could be... I'm not saying she would know really super modern stuff, but she would play anything from like really old school to what have you. So we always had a piano in our house, and my mum had a piano at her house, and I tinkled on it, but I never really played it. My sister Jane played it a little bit, but I didn't cross my mind, to be honest. I don't know why, it just didn't. And then when I was about 14, I always used to drum on the desk at school, and I just loved the whole thing about drummers, and I don't know what it was exactly, but... And I just wanted to get a drum kit. So my two brothers had motorbikes and I had a motorbike leather in anticipation of getting my first moped. And
in anticipation of getting your first drum kit.
Yeah, no, I swapped it for a drum kit though. That's the thing. I swapped it for this old crappy Ajax three-piece, no cymbals, just a hi-hat, like pigskins. It actually had pigskins on the drums. It was that old, right? And my dad had a little garden centre which had this pretty huge glass house, greenhouse. And he let me set the drums up at the end of that and play at night. And that's...
In glass?
Yeah, it was just stupid. The noise was ridiculous, yeah. He let us rehearse there for a while in the first band I was in. But anyway, I just had this inkling that I just really wanted to play drums. I think I'd got on the school drum kit one afternoon and just never got off it, if you know what I mean. Skipped a couple of lessons and got into trouble and just carried on playing old and thought I have to play the drums, and that's what I got into.
But do you play anything drums on your records now? Because a lot of those that you do are programmed.
No, it is programmed, yeah. I mean, we've recorded like kicks and hats and things because I like to do that sometimes. It just changes the dynamic of what... I don't know how much reality there is to that, but it makes me feel different. I think, well, if it makes me feel different, it might make the listener different, you know. So, but I do spend...
Did Taylor Hawkins let you have a go of his kit?
No, that is something I have to rectify at some point in my life, yeah. But, I've got various drum kits and I still love to play. And Simon, our drummer, who's great, and I love Simon, he understands that I love it so much that... He turns up at sound checks very often. He can hear me playing the drums kind of thing because I have to get on the kit. And obviously I've been so lucky and it's kind of happened again recently to play venues that I would have done anything to play at. And so I have to play drums in them as well. So for instance, when we played Hammersmith Odeon a few years ago, it's the first time I played it. I had to play drums. I've got to. I know I'm dropping a big one, but I played drums at Wembley recently because at Wembley Arena because it's like I've got to play drums at Wembley Arena. You
but
know what I mean?
Why don't you do one in the set?
We do occasionally. We do occasionally play like God, we're flitting around here. I've got a massive love of the album Highway to Hell. The song is amazing as well, but that album for me was a bit of a game changer in lots of. It's how I learned to play drums actually. I just played that record forever. I just kept putting the thing on and just playing to it forever. And I forget his name now. Phil, forget the drummer, what his name is.
Oh, my God. We had Brian Johnson on, didn't we? And I can't think what the drummer's called now.
I can't think what the drummer's called.
Shout out to the radio someone. Remember.
It'll come to me anyway.
But Phil Rudd.
Yes, Phil Rudd. And he is just... And again, you mentioned it. So the thing with Taylor Hawkins and obviously Dave Grohl and what have you. And I met those guys a few years back. And we got chatting about drums because you do and all the rest of it. And Dave Grohl was saying that his daughter, rather, was one of his daughters, was getting into playing drums and stuff. And we were talking and I said, well, I learned to play to Highway to Hell. And he went, oh, my God, he said, because he's related to that record as well. And I think he's plonked his daughter in front of it, he said. And it's just an amazing record anyway. I love the record. But the feel of it is... And it bridges that gap for me of like when records were overproduced at one point, especially in rock, where it's like it is a rock record, but it doesn't feel that human anymore.
The sort of Mutt Lange production.
Yeah, and I think he might have produced that.
He did, but it was before he did the sort of Def Leppard thing.
Before
it was absolutely perfect meat and two veg kind of, you know, one guitar Humans. Over here, one guitar over here.
Yeah,
you know, and when the solo starts, one of the guitars stops.
Yeah. No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's just you can tell it's music, you know, made by people. It's, you know, and
But Rick, I think I'm sort of peeking on your drum playing now, and I want to talk to you about your voice because you know, I mean, you're just like it's like the elephant in the room now. You as a singer, I mean, this voice, this baritone, would you call yourself a baritone?
I don't know, really. I don't even know what my range is, to be honest. I need to know what that is, but I don't. But yeah, I probably am more baritone.
Yeah, there's that one clip, isn't there? Well, there's actually two, although one seems to be an instrumental of FBI, of your first band playing at some local event. And it's there. It's completely fully formed. You sound so kind of great. It's this really weird sort of such a grown-up voice. In it.
Well, it is a bit guy weird, who it reminds me of, I think, a lot, is Luther Vandross.
Oh, my God.
You know, I mean, and in a particular, that when he was with Changes, Searching. That period just coming out, you know, when his first solo stuff outside of Bowie.
Yeah, but I've seen Luther Vandross live and what have you, a couple of times. And again... He made some albums that were a bit of a game changer in terms of. I've spoken to various singers and especially backing singers, to be honest, who, as we all know, are technically better than lead singers usually, and discussed his voice a little bit. And obviously, because he came from being a session singer, so he understood all of that as well. He was just on in a different league, really. I don't think I've actually heard anybody sing it all the way through the whole register in a way that he did. He seemed to have control over all of it somehow. And he is absolutely one of my all-time favourite singers. And he and a bit more old school, you know, Bill Withers, Al Green, I like most people who sing with a soul inflection or what have you, pinch stuff off them without a doubt, whether we're conscious of it or not. That those guys taught us to sing. It's as simple as that. So... to be mentioned in the same breath as him, to be honest, I'm very, very honoured by that. But I mean, I'm not fooling myself. I know what he was. As little as I do understand about how I sing, because I'm not very technically minded and I don't know how I do it, if you know what I mean. I know I'm not him. I know I'm not him. I'll tell you that.
You don't look like him, but you are close at times. When did you discover that's what you were good at?
Well, I sang... in school plays a lot, and I sang in anything at school. I was kind of press ganged into the local church choir because the vicar came to our school, made us all sing, and said, "Right, you're in the choir." But we used to earn a bit of money at the weekend at weddings and sadly funerals as well when we sang at that. And so that was, you know. But again, I actually think bizarrely, and the different worlds in lots of ways. But singing in a choir, even when you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, whatever I was. Sort of gave me a bit of a love of being around people singing. And when I'm anywhere near backing vocals and certainly like a proper gospel choir, it just melts me. It's just one of the most amazing things ever. And when the record 50 and what have you, I went that way a little bit and we did some sort of, you know, choral, whatever you want to call it, kind of BV things. And we have done it live where we've actually managed to get like 10 or 12 people in and do it. We did this gig in America, in LA, and we kind of, it was kind of like rent a choir, if you like, but we got these guys in and they were amazing. They really, and Dawn, who is what I've worked with for years.
Dawn Joseph. She did a tour with Spandau Ballet in 2010.
Yeah. Well, also nice, because you actually had the Andre Crouch choir, didn't you?
Yeah, they sang on Cry for Help, yeah, and that was a moment. To be honest, I've got a story about that, and I know it's about telling stories, isn't it? So I want to just tell this for a minute. So we're in Los Angeles. We're doing that song. We'd gone there to record a few things, actually, and also one of my favourite drummers, Vinnie Cagliuti, played drums on it as well, which is just like, what is going on? This is a kid from Nuclear Willows, and I'm like, anyway, it was just amazing. So the choir turn up, and they'd already obviously learnt something and got something together, and they go into the big room, and they're singing, and it was great, and we took it a couple of times, recorded it. Then they went out into the garden. I forget what this it's a very famous studio, but I can't remember what it's called right now. But anyway, it doesn't matter. So they got into the garden, and then one of them was out on the street for whatever reason and found this guy who was living rough, brought him into the garden. They got in a circle and prayed and sang for him. And at that moment, it made me sort of feel amazing, but it also made me feel very small at the exact same time. Because I'm like, I couldn't quite sort of compute or digest or what have you what was really going on, because there they are singing on my, you know, not belittling it, but pop song, and then they're actually singing, literally kind of saving somebody, if you like, or at least that's the intention. And I was just like, oh my God. And ever since I've sung that song, to be honest, which is quite a while now, and it doesn't come to me every night, obviously, but I do think about it and I do think of the connection. I do. And I also, like I say, the first time of singing in a choir at a church, you know, Church of England, C of E, couldn't be more kind of different in a way. There's still a connection. There's a human connection.
Well, yeah, a lot of small connection. The two biggest records I ever played on both have the Andre Crouch choir on.
Wow. Wow. What are they then?
Like a Prayer and Earth Song. And Earth Song.
Could you just film in about the guy? Guy, could you film in about Andre?
No, not really. I don't know anything. They were there.
I think, where's he based? Where are they based?
LA.
Los Angeles, I think, And I think he was the definite, I mean, without a shadow of doubt, and I don't even know, to be honest, I haven't checked whether he still does that. I don't know. I'm sure he does. But they were the choir to go to. Yeah. And that's why we went to Los Angeles for that couple of weeks. We tracked a load of things, and then we went and we got certain musicians. But we went for that choir. We went for Vinnie Cagliuti, like I say.
I know it's a great cast list on that. In fact, I was actually going to ask you about that, but we'll come to that later. But there's one name that's actually missing from that looks like that with the sound of the record and the musicians of that time. The one name that's kind of missing is Pat Leonard.
Well, listen, I mean, he's an amazing producer, incredible, But we to be honest, we were a bit on. It was a bit of a jolly, really, to just go. We had, you know, to be honest, it was. I had this weird feeling that I may never make records again after that, because I'd left Stock Aitken and Waterman. It was the first time I was making a record with instruments on it, if you know what I mean, and musicians, and obviously Matt and Mike are incredible musicians. But I mean, you know what I'm saying? Actually going out into lots of different studios and pulling in whoever you want for a specific sound or a specific thing. And I just thought this may be my one go, so let's go for it, you know. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've jumped ahead now because I wanted to get back to, because it's what seems quite. So you're in this, because FBI, was that mates from school or?
Yeah. I'm still actually really good friends. In fact, I texted with him this morning.
I was going to ask about
player.
That because he
lives down here as well. We kind of moved down to London at the same time. About three or four friends did actually, not all musicians, and we. There was three of us. It was a three-piece. We did a few Police covers. So I sang So Lonely from the drums. Sorry, Gary, we were talking about voice, weren't we? I'd sung in choirs in at school. And then when I got in bands as the drummer. But because we started doing covers and I was sort of able to sing certain songs and someone else wasn't. So I used to sing So Lonely. I used to sing a couple of others as well. I can't remember.
Yeah, but I've seen a film.
Hang on. You're playing Stuart Copeland and singing. That's pretty good multitasking.
Yeah, I'm playing it badly, by the way. I'm playing it badly.
But I saw a video of FBI, of you playing on stage at some event somewhere.
Right.
And you were fully formed then, Rick. I mean, you had the dance going. And
yeah, no,
that,
well
you sang
it's
like
interesting.
Like an elderly gentleman.
Well, it's interesting because I think the footage you might have seen is from a Battle of the Bands. And the first band I was in was called Give Way, and that's the guy who I'm still friends with today, who doesn't live too far away. We were a band at school. We were called Give Way, and we were called that because Jeff, the bass player, pinched a Give Way sign off the street one night when he had a shandy or two. I mean, we were only about 15 or 16 anyway. And we put that in front of the kitchen. Sure. And we just said, that's amazing. We are called Give Way. That's it, you know. Yeah,
yeah. Better than Oxo, I guess. Or
and we did a lot of... We did covers, and we tried to write songs and things, but we did covers... I think we played Transmission by Joy Division as well. We were quite eclectic, if you know what I mean. We played, and anyway, whatever.
But so Pete the next saw band, you do this, right? Pete saw you do this.
No, the next band I got in, proper band I got in, was called FBI. And they were like...
So there's still there's still a sort of police link there.
Well, yeah, kind of. Yeah, well, there was a KGB in our town as well, to be honest, but there you go. And we all knew each other anyway. There were two schools in our little town and we all knew each other. But that band, I didn't go to school with any of those guys. They went to the other school, Catholic school. I joined as the drummer, but they were doing a lot of rock and roll sort of covers, really, and some Beatles and stuff like that. And it was fun, but I just didn't really love it. I kind of wanted to, you know, and I came to rehearsals one day and I borrowed a guitar from one of the guys and he taught me three chords kind of thing, the three chords. And so I wrote a tune and I sang it and everyone went, okay, well, you're singing that then. And then that just sort of grew into me being the singer, basically. So we drafted in another drummer and I became the singer of that band. And then we went in for a couple of the Battle of the Bands. And the first one we went to this theatre in St. Helens. And we could, you know, when you've got those little speakers in your dressing room in a theatre?
Oh, yeah.
You can hear the stage.
The tunnel, yeah.
You can hear the stage, yeah.
Overtures and Beginners.
So we could hear this. Well, what we thought was the radio, right? The song is Everybody Wants Your Love. What is that song?
Rick Astley singing on our podcast.
Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Yeah, Casey and the Sunshine Band. Yeah. So that's coming through the speaker, and then someone said, "That's not the radio." And we went upstairs, and there was this covers band who were just phenomenal, right? They were probably better than Casey and the Sunshine Band. Probably played like five nights a week at the clubs in the north.
Right.
And we just shat ourselves. We just went, we can't go on after that. This is just a mess. And at this point, actually, I think at that one, I think I was still drumming and singing. And a couple of the other guys in the band sang. And I bought, and I still own it, a Dr. 55 Roland rhythm thing.
Oh, yeah.
We had a little drum machine thing going. And the songs that I'd written, we had the drum machine on. I went up and sang them. And some bastard had altered the tempo for us. So when somebody, I was at the front of the stage by this point with a microphone in my hand, and one of the guys pressed go on, and he went, anyway, and it was a disaster, basically. So we said, right, we have got to get our shit together. So, and there was another young band on, they were a couple of years older than us, and they all had black trousers, and they all had the same colour shirt, and they all had the same, and they looked like they knew what they were doing. So we all went into Manchester, we all kind of like scraped our money together, and we went to this, it's called Affleck's Palace in Manchester, and it's all little stalls and what have you, and younger designers make all stuff. So we all got these shirts. They weren't exactly the same, but they looked like we were in a band. Do you know what I mean? And we had black trousers. So that's when we started, right, we're going for this.
White socks, I noticed.
Well, come on. And I said, right, I'm gonna have a go at writing a song that at least, it might be rubbish, it might be whatever, but you won't be able to sort of deny it's whatever it is. And it was called Shake Your Ass. And and so we had a little dance to it, as you say. The guys used to do the sort of, you know, like the rockabilly sort of dance.
Oh, I saw it was like a shadow.
Yeah, and then I used to play like some massive big yellow tom toms along with Chris, the drummer, the new young drummer that we had. And we just thought we were it, and we just thought who could possibly not.
What year?
This has got to be 85, 86 possibly.
Right.
86 maybe, 85, 86. And Waterman had come up to be one of the judges on this Battle of the Bands. And he saw something, I don't know what he saw, but he saw something. So he got four bands, not from that actually, just other bands and what have you. Somebody put this showcase together and we were in it. And he's never told me this, and I don't know whether he did that because he wanted just to see us or whether he just, whatever, I don't know. But a few bands went and did this showcase just for him. He literally turned up to this working men's club where we just all set up and done this thing. And that's how I met Waterman, and that's how the thing of me just signing to him happened, because he saw something in my voice, not the shake your ass, I don't think, but in my voice, that he felt he could mould into something that was possibly going to be a hit record.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
This is what I find odd, Rick, is that, so this guy goes, yeah, it's the kind of like, yeah, come to London, I'll make you a star, I'm going to sign you. And so you leave your band, move to London, and then make tea in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
did
not
your mum, did your dad,
not quite what you had in mind.
Or? Yeah,
not
exactly. Your mum and dad must have been a bit concerned about you moving in with this bloke in London.
Yes and no. I mean, the first time I went down to Pete's, it was really early days. They had one studio at the time, and it was, I mean, to me, it was incredible. It was a 24 track recording studio. It was amazing. It was London, just London, London. It was amazing, you know. But it was early days. It really, really was, and I think they were working on the Princess record, I think, the Say I'm Your Number One record, which did go on to be a number one. I don't think Dead or Alive were there at that point. Anyway, a few months went by, and that to me is like an age. It's literally like, this is never going to happen. But they were busy, you know. And also, I don't know whether Pete at that point, I don't know whether he had lots of money to just throw around and sort of say, here's a deal, kid, even if it was for 25 grand or something, which was a lot of money back then, but still, do you know what I mean? I don't think they had money to throw around to sort of just say, right, we're going to make this record and we're going to put this kid up in London and we're going to, you know what I mean? I don't think it was like that yet.
But you were on the back burner making tea, is that right?
Yeah, I hadn't signed the deal at this point. The second time I went down, they were working on the Dead or Alive record. I ended up signing a deal. And I think the deal was just a very small production deal. And in fact, as the story goes, I seem to remember that you could do a thing called a YTS, which is a youth or a YOP or whatever, a youth opportunity scheme thing. Yeah.
Youth training scheme.
So they put me on one of them and gave me a bit of, maybe they gave me a bit of money as well. I can't remember. Anyway, so I was coming down on the train, really, and I was just kind of hanging out in London. I ended up staying at Pete's flat, which was in Crouch End, which was miles away from you know, where the studio was down
in
Surrey.
It was Borough, wasn't it?
Yeah, Borough, yeah. And it was just a mad existence. And I used to come in to the PWL studios, sat next to Pete in his Porsche, while he was on his massive, great big 80s phone, sometimes charming, but sometimes screaming at people, and just talking this language that I had no concept what it even meant, because it was part about money and business and bank loans and, you know, funding. And it was also partly record label deals and this, that and the other. And don't get me wrong, it wasn't like I was earwigging. I was just sat next to him. It was odd, you know. And so that in itself was quite a great experience to see that it is a real business. This is a business. It's not just, you know, the lights and the smoke and the...
Did you feel he understood the kind of music you wanted to make? Did the other guys understand it?
Well, interestingly, right, this is so... I wish I'd done notes, to be honest, to do this podcast, because it should have been more chronological. Right, Pete had a girlfriend, believe it or not, in the little town that I'm from, and it's a tiny town. And she had a hairdresser's, above or below, I can't remember which, a record store. And I think that's how he met her, because the guy who had the record store was a DJ called Kev Edwards, and he used to import records from America. And in Newton Le Willows, that's hyphenated, by the way, we still do a cricket club, and they used to have Monday nights, which was under 18, and Friday nights, which wasn't. And on Friday nights, Kev Edwards sometimes used to be the DJ, and we could get into both because we were that age where we could still hang out with our mates and younger girls and what have you, but we could also go to the over 18s and have a few jars. And Kev Edwards used to play records that, like early Luther Vandross, all kinds of records that were just, to us, were just like so soulful and so kind of... But the thing is, we all used to dress up to go there. We used to put jackets and ties on and dance in rows. And we were just doing what the older guys and girls were doing, to be honest. You know what I mean? We just followed them kind of thing. This was like a whole adventure to us. And Waterman, I know for a fact, I didn't know him at the time, and I wouldn't have been able to know he was there, but I know he's been to some of those nights. And I think he knew that I loved Luther Vandross and people like that and James Ingram and those kind of things. And I think that's where he saw me a little bit, as being, you know, a blue-eyed soul, whatever you want to call that kind of thing. And obviously, I think Britain definitely has a very, very, very strong tradition of producing singers who sing in a way and are influenced completely by America.
Yeah.
You know, I know we've got the other side of it. We've got Bowie, Morrissey, whatever you want to say, but we've also got this thing that is like, it's almost like we grew up on an island in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere. It's really weird, do you know what I mean?
I was kind of interesting when I talk to American musicians, especially how they don't understand how if any of us English kids grew up with Motown was absolutely a part of our DNA.
Yeah, you know? More than theirs, a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you think that, you know, Beatles, early Beatles tracks, they did Isley Brothers songs, and, you know, obviously The Who, hugely influenced by Motown. Yeah. I mean, that's... But you're right. I mean, everyone from Cliff Richard to Mick Jagger have been trying to sing like Americans.
Yeah, to be honest, unless your lyrics are a certain way and unless you have a very... I don't know how to put that, really. I mean, there's been singers, obviously, and there still is to this day, who sing in a British accent or wherever they're from, Scotland or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
But the truth of it is, someone gives you a microphone and you just start singing with an American accent. I don't know where that comes from.
But like, this has come up before, but you northern types, you have an advantage in that you say dance, romance, and
this
stuff anyway. So you don't have to do the pretentious repronunciation that Southern...
Yeah, that's very, very true.
And also, you were coming out of that very credible northern soul, sort of love of up-tempo, passionate dance music.
Yeah, but to be honest, I think that just came from being around it a bit through my sister and stuff. I couldn't. I've done it recently. I've actually gone on Spotify or what have you and sort of gone, okay, what are the 10 biggest Northern Soul songs? Because when somebody says to me, oh, you know, Wigan Pier was down the road and all the rest of it, and Wigan Casino was down the road, which is obviously where the big Northern Soul thing was, they think, oh, you must have really been into it. I'm like, well, I know some of it, and I know somewhere it's inside me because my sister hammered it forever, you know, and... But I wouldn't say I know much about it, to be honest. And even Motown, I don't think I'm like, I love what I know, But I wouldn't say I've gone that deep into it. You know, one of our favourite things to do, I don't know why, it just became a tradition, is we always play Motown records at Christmas. I don't know why it is. We decorate the tree. I think our daughter loved it when she was young, and she's 30 now, and she's still, you know, so we just play Motown at Christmas. I can't tell you why. I don't know why that makes sense.
No, because there's a lot of it is inherently Christmassy somehow.
Right, maybe so. Yeah.
But Rick, when was the first time you heard that backing track for Never Gonna Give You Up? I mean, was that literally the first thing you ever sang for them in the studio?
No, not exactly, no. We tried a couple of different things. I sang, they were doing some songs for a film, a British film that didn't really happen to be, or didn't really go anywhere. And I sang a song on that called Modern Girl, I think it's called. And again, I never sang it publicly anywhere. I just sang it, you know, just sing this, will you? I did, dump, that's it. It was a bit of experience. I also did a track that I sort of co-wrote with two of the younger guys, the kind of like, second team, if that's not the right way of putting it, but whatever, a guy called Phil Harding, a guy called Ian Kerner, who went on to produce loads of records, and Phil mixed so many of their records and was a massive part of giving them their sound, to be fair. Yeah. So I did a duet with a girl called Lisa, and again, Waterman's idea behind that, I think, was, with no disrespect to Lisa, but because obviously I was signed to them, was that we're going to get Rick's voice in clubs, and they don't know it yet. So it'll be there. And DJs will go, well, played that record. It only came out on a white label. There was no pictures. There was no what have you. So I had done a couple of little kind of testing things. But RCA, I think, were just getting the ump because they sent some money over, you know, many moons ago and had this kid signed and thought, well, when are we going to get to hear something? And I think Waterman was under a bit of pressure and we tried a couple of things. I sang a cover of Ain't Too Proud to Beg, which ended up on the second record, like a sort of totally slowed down version of it. Again, I think that was a tiny bit like, well, Paul Young's had a big hit, but we're doing a ballad version of, why don't we try that? Anyway, so we tried a couple of different things, but the first time I heard Never Gonna Give You Up was really weird because Phil Harding had been kind of brought in to be a sort of programmer to the building to some degree, I think, to Matt and Mike, but also to work with Phil and different things. So Ian Kernel comes in. I literally help unpack the Fairlight that Waterman had mortgaged whatever it was to buy. I literally helped him get it out of the box. He was a coffee addict, Ian, and I'd always have the coffee on for him because I was being like a tape-op tea boy as well. You know, I ran around, got the sandwiches, as a bunch of other kids did, and, you know, one of which is still one of my closest friends today. It was amazing to be there, to be honest. It was amazing. They were making hit records week in, week out. And as young kids, I just thought that was happening in studios everywhere. I just thought, well, you know, well, if you go to these other studios I've heard about, that must be... And it wasn't. People were in there making an album for 4 months that didn't see the light of day. And these guys were kicking them out every week. Anyway, I'll get back to Never Gonna Give You Up. So Ian was given this room down in the basement. Nice room, but down in the basement to set up as his programming suite. So he gets it all running. He's playing around. He's got a few things on the go. He's got a few, you know, external keyboards, all the rest of it. It was early, early technology. Mike Stock comes down, sits at the keyboard, puts the chords in to Never Gonna Give You Up, sings in the melody. I think maybe Ian might have noted that melody down or whatever, just so he knew what he was working against. He's kind of singing the melody to me, Mike, a little bit as well. But then told him what he wanted, how he wanted it, had some ideas for this and da-da-da. We want it to be a bit like this and maybe a hint of Philly strings and this, that, you know, Mike Stock, by the way, take nothing away from Mike Stock or Matt Aitken. I've worked since with a lot of people who are great musicians and very, very, very together people. They were incredible, I think. They were so, so, so underrated at how great they were. So then Ian starts to build Never Gonna Give You Up. And I'm sat there getting the biscuits and the coffee. And I just sat there on his shoulder just watching him do it. I'd never seen a Fairlight before. I had no idea. It was mind-blowing technology, as you guys, I'm sure, have used them back in the day and all the rest of it. It was a whole new world of making music with a computer and in a computer. And again, Ian is one of the most gifted people I think I've ever seen. He's just incredible, Ian Kernel. And that's the strings thing and the brass, I think, is Ian. And to me, it's such a massive part of the song because when those strings come in at the beginning, it's just like, boom, you're off, you know?
So I was just going to say, there's something, and this is annoying because I could have researched this easily. I didn't have time to listen through to everything.
Sure, go on.
Because isn't there a song on another song on your first album that uses the same backing track or it's the same thing backwards or something?
Well, I don't know whether it's exactly on that, But obviously, having been a tape op, i.e. getting tapes ready, putting them on the machine for a session and all the rest of it, because they used pretty much the same equipment all the time, like the same drum machine, a Lin 9000 as it was in the day. And they had some samples going even at that point. You could trigger samples from delays and all that. I'm sure you know all about that. And they could do, you know, but they were building their format, if you like, you know, and they had certain keyboards that they trusted and went to, like a DX7 obviously was the bass sound just stuff that they used. And so when they put on a tape, if it had like a 116 or 120 BPM sort of drum thing, and they go, well, let's just start with that. And right. And the fact that might have been someone else's record last week, who knows? Maybe right, Pete right. would
spring me up. Kit form records, wasn't it?
What about the lyrics? Kind of. Were they coming? Did they sort of come out in the room at the same time?
I don't know whether Mike and Matt and Pete. I don't know whether they'd written the lyrics at that point. I don't know whether they. I've got a feeling they had a rough idea of the lyric. Yeah, I seem to remember him singing it like a song, but don't quote me on that. You'd have to ask Mike Stock. But I think. Yeah, it wasn't. I don't know whether it's like 100% fully formed, but then what used to happen, although, and the way I did all mine, and I observed other people doing it, even though we were always cleared out of the room when people did the vocals, but you're around it enough. Mike Stock used to just sit you down at the desk, he'd put the track on, and he'd just sing you the song like three or four times, and you'd sing along with him, and then when you weren't getting it quite right, he'd sort of say, no, when you get to the middle, it's, you know, whatever, and give you a little. Then they'd send you in the booth, and then he'd work the shit out of you.
Because the secret to this song and why it's still long lasting, I think, is it has a really light up tempo, you know, sort of dance soul thing going on that we've heard a lot of times. But then this voice comes in that's got so much gravitas, confidence, and depth. Not like anyone else in Britain singing at that time. I mean, certainly not like Pete Burns or Jason or any of those.
Yeah, I mean,
but also
I think
it's a perfect chorus. It's the words of that chorus are a perfect list, which is why it's been so brilliant to use. I remember like people do jokes in election manifestos, like vote for him, or you could vote for Rick Astley because he'll never give you up, let you down, run around, or just say, you know, it's a perfect.
Totally, it's become another thing on the internet, obviously. But I think, to be honest, I still feel this today. I think I got the best song Stock Aitken Waterman ever wrote. And obviously other artists have their right to disagree with me, but I think that's the best one they ever wrote. And
The syncopation in the chorus is great.
I also think what's kind of interesting, because to put a bit of flesh on it, so they did that, and they've got it all going, and at some point I go up and do a vocal on it, but believe me, it went through so many changes you would not believe. So if you listen to the bass line of it...
Love to hear an early one. Actually, probably it's faster.
To be honest, it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently because as you get older and you just, you know... And I've met Ian a couple of times at gigs and stuff, and I don't know whether he ever took home a cheeky cassette at one point. But the bass line is very much like a song called...
It's
Colonel Abraham's...
Trapped.
Yeah.
Which, funnily enough, Trapped was... That Colonel Abraham's track was produced by Richard James Burgess, who produced the first two Spandau Ballet albums.
Oh my word, honestly, wow, that's incredible. Yeah. Wow, crazy.
And crazy. Obviously,
which is why Gary's now suing you.
And was in Landscape, which was an electronic kind of jazz band.
Einstein and Go-Go.
I remember Landscape.
And we're ahead of the game on electronica.
Wow, incredible. Anyway, crazy.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that. I thought that'd be like some Chicago sort of whatever, of hip-hop, you know. Yeah, crazy. But I loved that record. It's a great record. And I do think, to be fair to Pete Waterman, that is, I think he did want to make a record for me that he knew I would love. I think that was a big part of it for him, was that he wanted me to sort of feel that I could go out and sing it. Because... I was green as grass. I was really quiet. I was pretty shy, to be honest. I felt completely out of my depth. I'd never even spent time in London before, never mind in studios and everything. And I kind of feel that they messed around with that song so many times you would not believe until they came up with the version. And I know since that Mike and Matt weren't completely convinced that my voice on that record, or any kind of record, to be honest, that it was just a mismatch. It was like, what are we doing? This kid looks 11 years old. He's got reddish hair. How can you do? We can't release this. What are you doing? You know, And interestingly, it went to number one, and the week it went to number one, we made the video for it. So the only time people saw me was on Top of the Pops. In the couple of times I went on Top of the Pops to try and get it up the chart, as it were, right. Obviously. So if you hadn't been, and I know everyone watched Top of the Pops, but if you hadn't watched it, you hadn't seen me.
Yeah.
So, right. And I don't know whether that was on purpose, but we're talking about RCA Records here, and we're talking about PWL. They'd had a few hits by then. They knew how to do it, yeah? And yeah. I'm like, I didn't think much of it. I just thought, oh, you know, they've just thrown it out and we'll see what happens. And it just went boom, and they weren't ready for it. It's like, we better make a video.
The one thing that always sprung to mind with me with that video is it's like you're doing a next catalogue shoot.
Well, all the clothes in it are mine. All the clothes in it are mine. I haven't got any money at this point, obviously. And
this is the raincoat and the polo neck, right?
They're all mine. Yeah, they're all mine. All of it. Every single item of clothes. I turned up with a holdall with clothes in it and went, well, what do we do now? And then
That's three strong looks, Rick. Double denim.
What happened to that coat? Have you still got it, Rick?
No, it drifted away. I've told this story before. It's,
that's right, yeah.
I did an outside broadcast in Northern Ireland with Eamon. Too much coffee this morning. Presents on the morning show, you know.
Eamon Holmes.
Yeah, Holmes. Of course, yeah. Lovely fella. He was doing a radio outside broadcast there. And the record by this time was like kicking off big time. So we were kind of getting mobbed, both of us, you know. And before I know what I'm doing, my jacket's being pulled off my back. And it's like, it's just drifting away. I can just see this raincoat going. I'm like,
over the crowd.
I bought that.
Who's
and,
got it?
Yeah. And I have no idea. Somebody in Northern Ireland. It's in someone's grandma's.
It should be in the V&A.
Well, there you go.
I have one of those coats because Mick Jones wore one with BAD.
Yeah. I mean, I think I could have really got into clothes, I think, at that age. But we didn't have any money. So we just kind of emulated what we saw in the cheapest way we could. But what I still can't believe now, thinking about it and talking to you guys, is that we went to make a video and I had no idea what was going to happen. Not a clue. Here's the treatment, here's the this, here's the that. It's just turn up. Because I think also because that record took off so quick, it was ridiculous. It was just ridiculous.
Yeah, but just think that this kid turns up with a plastic bag full of clothes. And what you did that night has had over 1 billion views on YouTube.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is pretty weird to be.
One seventh of the planet.
The greatest meme of all time. You know.
But I think the thing is, that's the weird thing about that whole thing with Never Gonna Give You Up, is that I've got my memories. And I've got my universe of it, if you know what I mean. And to be honest, bluntly, it's paid for me to have a great life, really. And it still is, if you know what I mean. And I don't want to be crass and bring money into it, but I kind of like bringing money into it, to be honest, because I'm fucking grateful for it. I really, really am.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't ever want to have that leave me, if you know what I mean. I would have probably had a go at doing it anyway. Obviously, I think any of us would, because you don't do it for the money. Obviously, there's the fame, the money, the what have you. But that's not really why you're doing it. It's just something inside you. But having made some money out of it and having that song and some that came after it, obviously, kind of take care of me for the rest of my life. It's just been something I'm eternally grateful for. And I refuse to let myself forget it. And so I have my universe of it, if you like. But then it's got this other thing sort of simmering away, where it's been used for so many different things, like you say, some loads of fun things and the Rick Roll thing and everything.
We're going to just have to talk about the Rick Rolling now.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I just thank God your name isn't Dick.
Yeah, well, could be. It is to my friends, but anyway, let's not go there.
I didn't know much about Rick Rolling, but it's basically this where people get sent links to look for something that they think is serious or is about something else, and when they click on it, they're sent straight to a video of you.
Exactly, yeah, and they're tricked into watching Never Going to Give You Up, basically. But I think the thing is as well, it's been, you know, we get offers for the song to be used or even the video to be used in loads of different things all the time. And, you know, it's been in Fortnite. They've even done the dance, the sort of Rick Astley shuffle in Fortnite and all the rest of it. And there's a part of me that sort of thinks, Well, I remember when it very first started, the first Rick Roll kind of thing, and a friend of mine who lives in Los Angeles, actually, he Rick Rolled me. And I'm like, I was on holiday at the time in Italy, actually. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So I just replied back, what? He did it again. And I'm like, okay. So I got him on the phone in the end because I just thought this is ridiculous. And he said, so you don't know about this? I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Why do you keep sending me my own video kind of segued into, you know, somebody doing something else, whatever it is? And he kind of explained it to me. And I still didn't get it, to be honest. I didn't get it for quite a long time.
I don't think I get it, to be honest.
No. Well, I don't. But that's, we're probably not of the age to get it, to be fair. But it's sort of morphed.
It started on 4chan, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just morphed into something else completely. And I think early on, I kind of said, I have to be really careful not to get to embrace that too much, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, because I'd be worried as an artist. Is this a piss take, or is this this being, or is this, should I be just accepting that people are just using my video as a sort of massive distraction from the horrible side of life? You know.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and I think, to be honest, I think a lot of artists of a different temperament or mindset would have been devastated, if I'm honest, because it's sort of taking what you regard as your thing and your art or whatever you want to call it, and throwing it into this, into the lion's den of like nonsense, right? But I also can see, and again, you see, I was kind of retired at the time. I wasn't even gigging at the time. I wasn't really, do you know what I mean? So I was, it was just happening. It was like, what the hell? And then it was around that time that I did start gigging, actually, funnily enough, because we had this crazy offer, like I say, to go to Japan and do the gigs. And I did this, I even said that when I walked out and did those gigs, the first night out in Tokyo or whatever it was, and I kind of said, this is the biggest karaoke happening in Tokyo tonight. Let's get on with it, you know, and sang the songs. And I kind of think that it's definitely helped. It's definitely helped with my social media presence. Of course it has. It's massive.
Yeah. I mean, you went on TikTok.
The first kind of, I don't know if this was your first being aware of any connection with the Foo Fighters, was when they, is actually a brilliant political statement when they Rickrolled the Westboro Baptist Church.
Exactly, and I kind of think
brilliant. That's basically like turning you into the Clash or something.
Yeah, maybe
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. I don't know about it. No, so, but it was. Well, it was protesting through joy, you know, which is
Of course. Well, the thing is that those guys have picked a fight with Foo Fighters, I think, and
picked a fight with everyone.
Yeah, with everyone, yeah, but them in particular, I think at this. So, in other words, when they went, as you say, they went and Rickroll them on the back of a pickup truck, which was for me was just incredible, and I was just like, I don't know what's going on, but I'm loving whatever's going on. I'll just leave it at that. Yeah. And a couple of the guys in their crew, like there's one or two of them, just massive as well, and it's like, and they're all singing this song. I'm like, okay, whatever. And then, so obviously they knew the tune and everything, and then I think they learnt, actually I'm not sure what the sequence is, but anyway, I got to do a huge big festival in Japan again, funnily enough. A lot of great things have happened in Japan, but there you go. And I am a bit of a closet rocker. I play drums in a 3-piece band with some friends, and we only play like punky rock stuff, basically. That's all we do. And we only do it for charity, because that's how we get away with it. And I play drums and sing, and we have a bass and a guitar. So we play a few Foo Fighters songs. We go from Pistols Clash right the way through to anything that's like, you know, we're called the Luddites, because if it doesn't happen immediately with no technology, it ain't happening. And so I am a big fan of theirs anyway, and I've you know, I love Nirvana, obviously, who doesn't? And I think all the way through Foo Fighters, it's been a really interesting journey with what they've done. So we're there, and I said to my wife and some of the guys that you know wanted to go, I said, look, we can probably get on the side of the stage if we just wing it and just go up there. So we're kind of wandering up to the stage, and their crew and all their security and guys were amazing. They just said, just plant yourselves wherever you want. We'll get you some drinks. You're cool. It's all fine. And then suddenly they came out, and they just, there wasn't a roof, but if there would have been, they would have taken it off. The place just went mad, you know. And it's pretty ferocious the way they play live. It's full on. And so we're just absorbed in it. I've had a few beers by now, because my set was way before in the afternoon sort of thing. And one of the guys, who's one of the guitar players, Chris Shiflett, comes over and gives a big hug to a friend at the side of the stage. So we all moved out of the way so he could do this and everything. And then a couple of songs later, Dave Grohl's coming over. So we're all kind of moving out of the way, thinking he knows this guy and he's about to give him a hug. And he comes over to me. And so I was like, okay, what is going on? And he just gave me a big hug. He said, hey, I'm Dave. And I said, I'm Rick. And that, you know, and he said, hey, man, cool. Walked out onto stage. And I'm like, okay, that was odd, but great. You know, what a lovely thing to do, you know. A couple of songs later, somebody from the crew comes over. He's got a mic in his hand, moves the barrier, gives me the mic. And he said, Dave wants you out front. I'm like, oh, fucking hell. You know, I'm thinking he's probably going to invite me out and sort of say, you never guess who's here, everybody. It's that dude. And that's all I think he's going to do. Like, here's Rick, you know, we've Rickrolled you. What, or whatever. I don't know what he's thinking. I have no idea what he's thinking. No idea at all. And by this stage, I'm jet-lagged to buggery and I've had a few beers, right? So I'm just thinking, whatever. So he whispers in my ear, he says, so we're going to do your tune, but it's going to sound a bit like Teen Spirit. And I said, okay. So they just steam into it. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. There's 50, 60,000 people in a baseball stadium in Tokyo. I don't actually know what to do. So believe me, I was not trying to be rock and roll. I just didn't know what else to do. I just went to the front of the stage and screamed for all I was worth, come on, you motherfuckers.
Yeah.
And then we sang Never Gonna Give You Up to sort of the backing of Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yeah.
It was just weird. And they jammed it in the room. They have a little jam room before they go on. I found this out later. They jammed it in the room and said, if we see that dude, we are definitely playing this. And sure enough, they saw me, so they definitely played it.
There must have been a bit of you at that moment thinking, this is the most credible thing ever. This has just jumped my career into another area that I never thought I'd become part of.
Honest to God, I've thought about things like that since, because people have said to me sort of like, oh my God, so you've met Dave Grohl and you've hung out with those guys. And, you know, and I've thought, we'd had a few. We really had a few. Do you know what I mean? Because we were just going to get on a long flight home the day after. Yeah. And I got out. I was so kind of like not in my own world at all. And I was pretty nervous as well, because I wouldn't have judged those guys to do anything cruel or piss-takey anyway, but I had no clue of what they were going to... I had no idea what they were doing. I didn't know whether they'd had a few, and they were just sort of going, is this dude? What, I don't know, whatever, you know.
I met Dave and Taylor because we did a TV show with Spandau Ballet when we got back together in the 2000s, 2010. And they came straight up to us.
Mm.
They are British pop 80s obsessives.
Yeah.
Before they did all of their grunge stuff, that's what they were into as kids.
No, totally. Well,
you know,
well, you
MTV
know,
and the
you're somebody you know very well, Toby on keys, yeah?
Toby Chapman. Oh,
yeah. Toby was with us that time because we'd gone through this thing of whatever. So Toby came to play keys for us. And when they found out Toby was with you guys, they just couldn't believe it. They were like, oh my God. And they were like singing Spandau Ballet songs and all the rest of it. And it was just, I 100% agree. One of the things I do love about them actually is I know they're a rock band. It says that on the tin. You know what I mean? They are a rock band. Absolutely. But in their playing and obviously their influences and the way they go about it and everything, it's like they're an everything band. If you know what I mean, it just comes out with a rock sort of edge to it because
there's a real pop sensibility to the writing.
Yeah, musicality is crazy. It's like and I've always thought that. And that's, you know, a lot of their songs as well. Because, I still kind of put my headphones on and drum to records all the time because I like it. You know, I've got real kits, but I've got an electric kit as well because of the neighbours and a lot of their stuff is stuff that I can't keep up with it. I can't do it, but I enjoy it because it's. It's technically amazing. It's a bit like when I was young trying to play the Police. It stretches you because it's like it's something different. The time signatures and the way they accent things and go about stuff is just really technical. Yeah. Well, technical is perhaps not right, but it's just really musical, let's say. Yeah.
Inventive.
And, inventive, Rick,
Rick, what's next for you?
We are going to America to do a load of gigs. And this is kind of a crazy one, but I'm really looking forward to it. I've been invited by New Kids on the Block. They've done this a few years running now, I think, or every few years. Salt and Pepper and En Vogue. So I'm all over that in terms of songs and everything.
Wow, yeah.
So the four of us are going to...
Have been around the block a few times.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, New Kids on the Block, I get it.
They did. They covered a song that I was part of. Set Adrift on Memory Bliss was on their big album.
Oh, really? Oh, wow, okay.
New Kids on the Block. Get to dig it out.
Yeah, massive, yeah. And And it's going to be a lot. I mean, one of the fun things, and something that I sort of, it's really weird because I kind of really miss it, but I'm also unbelievably grateful that the record 50 and what have you, and since then I've been able to sort of go out and do bigger gigs myself and sort of go and just, you know, do my own whatever. But I've done loads of gigs with other artists where you only play your hits. And yes, it's retro. It's a trip down memory lane. And I kind of love it. And I've stood at the side of the stage with artists' records. Sorry, with artists that I've bought and loved their records and know them note for note. And I'm about, or have just been on stage, the stage they're on. Like Level 42 is one of my all-time favourites.
Yeah, because you co-wrote with Mark King.
I did. Yeah. And I think, again, he's one of those, he's an animal, that guy. He's an animal. He can play anything. He's the most unassuming. He talks in such a way about his musicianship that it's like, well, I just this and I just that. And he's a crazy drummer. Great guitar player, to be honest. I don't know about, you know, widdly widdly, but in terms of like his chops playing the guitar, just great. And, that you know, Level 42 were definitely one of the bands that we all aspired to in terms of, you know, they were just amazing musicians. And it was allowed. It was allowed to be a musician in pop music. It was like, these guys can actually do it. And again, you guys know all about it. You know, you've been there and done it and all the rest of it. We're in a moment where there are some great musicians. There are some great bands. There's always something great. Of course there is. But the 80s has got a really weird thing, because the beginning and the middle of the 80s was very, very much about artists being musicians. And the end of it, and unfortunately, I'm definitely part of the end of it, that sort of drifted away. It went totally pop and just like, just sing the song, love. We don't really care whether you can play, we don't care if you can read, to be honest, or you can talk. We're not really bothered. As long as
and then
the
early
song,
90s with the Uber A&R men, like, you know, Simon Cowell.
Yeah. And it's just, so, and listen, I don't have an axe to grind, I don't have anything. I'm just saying that's part of the rich tapestry of it all, I guess. But a lot of those gigs that I've done, like the Rewinds and whatever, Henley and different things like that, you know, ABC, my God, did I love some of their records. And I've got to know Martin a bit and hung out with him and all the rest of it. And, you know, and obviously Tony as well, and, you know, and your records and, you know, just records that...
But you're doing the Smiths now, aren't you? Quickly before we have to say goodbye to you.
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't like doing the Smiths now, but yeah, I did. It's a long story. I did a podcast, funnily enough, so that you be careful, guys. You never know what can happen on a podcast. With Blossoms, which is a band from Manchester area. And we got talking about influences and what this, that and the other. And I said, you know, as a younger guy, one of my brothers was really into the Smiths and I really got into it as well. And I think later on in life, I always had this dream that at some point in my life, I'd just go and do a set of Smith songs just for the fun of it, because I do it in the car all the time. I was building a shed this year, actually, or last year, I should say, and that I just went through catalogues. I love doing it. And where you go to the very beginning of someone's career and just listen to every record they ever made. And anyway, so I was doing the Slate Roof, get me, and... it was lockdown. We did a lot of crazy things. And I just listened to the whole Smiths back catalogue. And I mentioned my love of the Smiths to Blossoms and said, at some point in my life, I want to go on a stage and just sing their tunes. People will slate me for it. They'll kill me for it. They'll do everything they want, but I just don't care anymore. I don't care anymore. So anyway, something must have been seeded there, because a couple of weeks later, they got in touch and said, well, we'll be the band. So they were doing some gigs. And I got up with them and we sang a couple of tunes. We did this Charming Man, obviously. I can't remember what the other tune we did, actually. It might have been Panic, maybe. And that was to announce that we were doing the gigs, because I'd secretly gone up to their rehearsal room up in Stockport and we'd thrashed through a few of the songs. And we all just looked at each other and said, we're going to get absolutely fucking murdered for this, but we don't care. And so we just said, right, we're doing it. And we did them, and we did two gigs. We did one in London and one in Manchester. And it was just incredible. It was just amazing. And I understand, and I really do, I really, really empathise and all the rest of it with people who were horrified by it.
No.
I just don't care, to be honest. I loved it. And, you know, Yeah.
I think this is probably a good time to say goodbye to this charming man then, isn't it?
Go on. There you go.
That's pro, isn't it?
Don't panic. But
that's probably the sort of thing Eamon Holmes might say as a single.
Indeed. I love your banter between the two. It's working well.
Having you on has been incredible. And we've gone really way over our usual time. And I think that's because you are a raconteur.
Yes.
Listen, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. And I love the show, by the way. I'm not just saying that. Giles, who you know, obviously mentioned some time ago actually that he was doing this thing. I said, "Oh, check that out. It sounds interesting." And I've listened to loads of them, and I really, really enjoy it. It's one of the things it's made me do is listen to records again. Brilliant. And if nothing else, even though it's great, by the way, just listening to the show. But if nothing else, it stopped me in my tracks going, there's no way he played that on that. There's no way somebody did that. And I go back to the record and I go, bugger me, they did. And I've loved it. I've absolutely loved it.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks, Rick.
It's a treat. It really is.
Gave Joe Elliott a run for his money there. I mean, what a lovely, affable man with what a story.
I know, just endless stories. And also, Camel, who would have thought? Camel were one of his first bands.
Especially after we thought we had to get the prog out of the way in the intro.
No one thought they'd be listening to the Rick Astley episode and going off and listening to the Snow Goose, did they?
Exactly, but they will. And that's why you need to keep it here, people.
You do. Because, and as Rick said, you know, you can learn so... You're going to go back to so many records by listening to our show. And we hope you listen again next week. And loads of nice messages coming up on social media. Send some questions in. We would love to answer them.
Would we?
Well, I might. You might, yes, you might get the arm. Yeah.
Oh, they'll all be for you.
So good. We say goodbye then.
We say goodbye. Thanks so much. Thanks to Ben, our producer. Thanks to all of you for listening. And good night from me.
And it's good night from all of us.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.